referencing. In other words, you're invoking something nostalgic, you're invoking something storied. It's not just a scientific, a geographical designation. You're bringing up images and feelings there. It fits with what the psalmists are doing because they're not just remembering a geographical place, they're invoking all of the history that's attached to that place, the great city of the Jebusites, that David took in a surprising and unlikely military victory that you may have read about in the book of 1 Samuel and the 1 Samuel. All the stories and memories of how God gave this shepherd boy this unlikely victory in the great city and how he came to dwell in it and make it his home and all of the blessings that followed as Solomon took over and eventually built that first grand temple at the highest point in the city, overlooking even higher than the city of David, during the high water mark of the United Kingdom before it was divided into when all of Israel, just for that time, all 12 tribes were united together. That is Zion. And they're invoking all of that and remembering all of that. You will see that the idea of singing that song associated with those things now in Babylon is like, you can't be serious. How can you expect that song to be sung? And you can almost sense the appalling nature of this request because he says, you know, you're tormentors, but then he heightens it. It's not just that they're captors. They haven't just been taken captive. They're being tormented, perhaps by the very request itself. And by the way, this is the only place in the whole Old Testament where that word translated, tormentors, is used. Verse 3 is a good example of Hebrew parallelism. It says, our captors required songs, our tormentors mirth. You know, Hebrew, even in the original, you don't have rhyming. Almost never do the words rhyme. But the idea is rhyme. And so we can still see it even mid-translation. Captors rhymes in meeting with tormentors and songs with mirth. But in both cases, it's extended. So it's not just captors, it's tormentors. And it's not just songs. It's not just any song. It's a request to sing something joyful. And here there is a heightening of anger towards these tormentors. And this is the point. The psalmist is so caught up in his tormentors and what they are doing to him that he becomes right about what he's saying. His heart isn't in a place where it's even possible to worship God in the right way. But is it God's fault that they're there and they're being tormented? No. Through ministry of the prophets, particularly one that comes to my mind is Jeremiah. They've been warned about the Babylonians over and over. They had been warned, in part because their worship was in the wrong place, because their hearts did not change. So now the question is it God's desire that they stop worship now? Is this a redemptive sort of theme that they've stricken here, saying that no, they will not worship in a foreign land? And I think they're wrong in this case. For one thing, because we have evidence of other places in Scripture where people do worship on foreign land. Paul and Silas are taken captive on foreign turf. They're thrown into prison in Philippi for casting out the demon of a slave girl. And we have to dispense with the notion of ruby cells and of mules or of libraries or any of those things. These were more like caves. And then foreign turf in a cave after being unjustly imprisoned for doing something good. Do they beg God, Paul and Silas, do they beg God to repay their captors? Do they focus on how evil the people are that have thrown them in prison? No. Their attention isn't on their captors, it's on God. The first few verses of Psalm 137 are not about God, they're about man. They reflect a worldly way of thinking. One that has tunnel vision and that is fixated on what has been done to oneself. Ever been there? Ever realized in the midst, perhaps even of worshiping God or trying to worship God, your heart and mind are focused on what someone nearby has said or done to you recently, or maybe someone hundreds of miles away has done recently, and your worship is stifled because how can I worship God in this situation? Surely I can be exonerated from thinking about, from meaning the words of this song, or take it outside of the music, from being challenged by a sermon, or having my heart turned or changed or challenged by scripture when this thing is so fresh that it has just happened. I can be put into that boat without question. And maybe we don't always voice the unresolved conflicts that are keeping us from worship, but we think them. And the psalmist here then caught up in a very common problem, the endless cycle of they did this to me and now I have to do this. She said this and now I'm going to make sure next time I see her and have the chance I'm saying that thing. He didn't invite me to be a part of that group, and so next time I'm not going to invite him to my thing. And the cycle is endless. It stifles our worship. And it's hard to worship God when you're in the past replaying those kinds of things. Your heart and mind are not there. Psalmists are caught up in what man had done to them. Paul and Silas were not focused on that kind of thing. They were focused on God. Secondly, focus on forms can hinder grace. Focus on others can. I feel like I didn't resolve that, and will resolve that at the end, because I think there's a way that the person of Christ resolves each of these things. But before we do, number two, the focus on forms can hinder grace. We tend to think of worship in terms of music, and that's a very important, and, the right place for worship is in music. You know, music looks a lot different depending on where you are. I was thinking again, back to my past. When I was in high school, my best friend, who is now a missionary in Germany, I went to her house and hung out with her family. It felt like just about every night of the week. I was sort of my home away from home. And even on Sunday nights sometimes. And I came in the door one Sunday afternoon, and her dad and her were heading out the door. And he said, "Josh, I'm preaching at a church in Pennsylvania." They lived in Pennsylvania. "Small church in Pennsylvania tonight. You and Chris are going to come with me." Mel was like twice as big as me, so I didn't argue with it. Realized, okay, tonight I'm going to some church in Pennsylvania. And so we took a long drive through Pennsylvania, and we ended up at this small country church. And before we even got in the door, a man who was in charge of the service greeted us. And he said, "Mel, I need you not just to preach, but also to lead worship, lead music tonight." Well, I knew Mel, and he would say of himself, he would say, "I can't even play the radio, let alone an instrument, let alone sing." He could not carry a tune. And so he immediately turned around and he said, "Josh, that's going to be up to you." So I walked into this small church in Pennsylvania, and I saw the three hymns for the night that were on the board. We used to have church at night. I grew up going to church every Sunday night. It's not as much a thing anymore, but it almost feels strange to talk about going to church at night, but that was normal. And they gave me a hymnal. They said, "Here are the hymns." I had never seen any of them, and I grew up singing hymns, and I had never seen any of these hymns. They were from like page 872, way in the back of the hymnal. This hymnal looked like it was written in calligraphy in the 1500s. I could almost not even read the words. And so we started the whole service with a hymn. So I arrived at the church within 2 minutes. We were running late. Within 2 minutes, I was standing in front of people I'd never seen, the hymn I had never heard before. And I thought, if I ever preach someday, I've got a sermon illustration. So in case you're wondering how it went badly. I looked at the pianist, and she looked at me, and I realized she wasn't going to do anything until I did something. And so I did the only thing that I'd ever seen a music leader do in my past as a child singing hymns. And then as I raised my hand like this to lead the worship, and as soon as I did, she started to play, and I did my best to mumble through the words that I had never seen. The low moment was when I looked up and there was an 11-year-old girl in the front row making fun of me, going like this. Now, if you think about how different worship can be from church to church and from decade to decade, that pales in comparison when we think about the worship experience the psalmists are used to when compared to the kinds of worship experiences that we are used to. And they seem to really need that context, whatever it was, however different it was from our own. They seem to need that context because it says in verse 4, "How shall we sing the song of the Lord in a foreign land?" That's called they're saying, we can't sing the song of the Lord in a foreign land. It's not possible. He says in verse 6, then he holds Jerusalem as his highest joy. I love that song that we sang this morning that was about this psalm. I heard it and I forgot it. And it's a great song for this context because, and it's great that it was in a minor key. I think the minor key is the right one for this particular psalm because there should be some doubt as to whether this is actually a good notion. Is this a good statement? Highest joy, a town, a city. Is it worthy of the highest possible joy? Should it give someone the highest joy that one can give? Well, here's what St. Augustine said when he talked about well-ordered loves. How should we choose what we love, what we give our affection to? How do we know we're loving in the right way, in loving the right things? He says this, a holy person, and he says six things, and it gets a little difficult to follow, but at least the first time you hear it, it does. But he says this, a holy person, number one, does not love what he ought not to love. And number two, does not fail to love what he ought to love. Number three, does not have greater love for what ought to be loved less. Does not love less what ought to be loved more. Does not love equally, number five, things that should be loved more or less. And number six, does not love less or more things that should be loved equally. Now, I will not read that again. If you want to look it up later, you can. What St. Augustine, of course, is saying there is that as we think about how to live as believers, what we love is one of the highest concerns, one of the most important things to have in mind. And that was our section to Geneva School across the park here. And that was our theme last year, and so our students got to hear that very often. And what we see here is that for the psalmist, his affections, his loves, are not really following that. He's loving something, not something bad, but something that's not as good as it should be when you consider he's made it his highest love. Now, there's a story being told here in Psalms, and we've already alluded to it. Just like there's a story in Genesis, or Kings, or in Acts. People love stories. I love stories. I spent my life reading stories almost constantly. And I'm happy, realize years ago that there is a story being told in Psalms. It's a different kind of story, perhaps. But this part of the story that we're in goes from Psalm 107 to 150. And that, of course, is book 5, the last book of the book of Psalms. Much of book 5, you might know, is composed of psalms of ascent. These are psalms 120 to 134. They sing of the pleasures of approaching Jerusalem on a pilgrimage, one of those three pilgrimages each year that every Jewish person would take during the Second Temple period from wherever they lived in Israel to Jerusalem, which was set up higher than anything around it. It was one of the highest points. It was the highest point in southern Israel. And it's possible that each of these psalms was sung not only on the way to Jerusalem, but during the final ascent once they arrived at the Temple Mount, because there are 14 steps going up to the Temple Mount. And a lot of people think that each one of these psalms was sung on a different step, so that when you approach Jerusalem, everything would slow down and you wouldn't just rush in. You would take your time, and everything would go into slow motion. You would savor the moment of having arrived after your journey and praying each of those psalms as you approach. And then after Psalm 134, after those wonderful psalms of ascent, we have Psalm 135, which also ends well in praise to the Lord. In contrast to the psalm that we read, it ends in praise to the Lord. And then we see Psalm 136, and if you ever try to read Psalm 136, every single verse, if you look there, ends in the same way. His steadfast love endures forever. The story is therefore being told of what worship looks and feels like, what good worship for God should be in terms of its focus and its phrasing and things like that. And what was the familiar context for the psalmist? If you're reading through these psalms in context, like we've just mentioned, Psalm 137 comes as a shock. If you just hear it isolated and read on a Sunday morning, you miss that. But if you look back and if you're reading through those psalms, it is a shock. All of the psalms leading up to this one are great psalms of worship for God, and then we get here and we go from proper delight in worship at the temple to an unhealthy preoccupation with worshiping in a certain way, and if it's not this way, and if it's not this place, then I'm not going to worship. They were longing for that pilgrimage. The exiles were, that wrote this psalm, they were longing for that pilgrimage to the temple. The familiar routine, making that trip a few times a year, stopping at the same places you had always stopped at with your family, with your mind fixed on what it would be when you arrived and knowing what was going to happen, and then approaching the temple, stopping at each step as you ascend the temple steps, and all of those nostalgic things. And the problem is, that's not love for God. It's the longing for the church potluck. I don't know if people do potlucks anymore. When I grew up, I didn't really like going to the church potluck except to see my friends, but we would have a church potluck. And it was a wonderful time of fellowship and getting to see people that was familiar. It's not that, though. It's a trip to the apple orchard with your family on the weekend or the neighborhood barbecue. Good things. But don't mistake those with worship for God. That's not worshiping God in prison after you've been unjustly put there. It's not worshiping God when you find out your spouse has cancer, or you've lost your job, or your rent is going up. Or even, maybe more difficult, worshiping God during the mundane times when everything is just kind of going okay. Sometimes I think that's maybe the most difficult time to maintain worship and real love for God on a consistent basis, the real challenge. And the reality is that the psalmist is now facing this comfortable and nostalgic worship would not translate out of the comfort zone he is longing for. He can't take it on the road. He can't take it out of that place. It has to be there. He can't take it in a real way. It needs to fortify his heart, lift his spirit, experience the presence of God in a different place. He couldn't take it on the road. Now, obviously, I'm not disparaging trips to the apple orchard, barbecues, and potlucks. My family does all of those things. Also, not saying that worship, church worship, should be the best it can be, that those moments are vital in the life of believers. But it's thinking that everything has to be comfortable and expected, and that I can't worship without this situation and this place, without the right setting, the right people, and so on, that's called religion. It's thinking that the forms and the worship, the ambiance, or whatever, or all that matter. It doesn't matter if it's old and familiar or contemporary and familiar music. Whether it's old music, you can't worship God without, or new music, you can't worship God without. But that, it has to be about music at all. It has to make me feel a certain way and create an effect. Go outside of that context, and we're saying the same thing that the psalmist is saying. How can I worship God in this church, in this place, without all of these things? How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? It's like, what else could you expect to sing it? This whole world is a foreign land. We know because both Peter and Paul refer to it as such. You are called to sing the song of the Lord in a foreign land. This is why the Babylonians had to be exiled. Why they are by the rivers of Babylon to begin with. They weren't really worshiping, even in their own land. So how do you sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? It's the only place you can worship God, and you've been called to worship God in a foreign land. And they were missing it. And our job is, how do I take my love for God, my worship for God, out of this place and into my workplace, into the university, into my place of employment, into my daily home life, into my grocery shopping, into whatever it is that makes up your daily routine. Not how do I engage in singing songs in those places, most likely, maybe, but maybe not. But how do my words and my actions pour out love for God, worship for God, in those places that aren't the familiar context, so that I am not like these psalmists who find themselves paralyzed without everything in their surroundings being just what they should be. Lastly and thirdly, undue focus on self can hinder praise. Undue focus on self can hinder praise. We have to talk about these last verses, you know, and maybe we could have talked about how their focus on Zion and Jerusalem was a good thing if it hadn't been for the warning signal of these last couple of verses. And I say this in part because the term remembering is actually a very important one in the Old Testament. That's what they say to God in verse 7. They invoke God to remember something. This is a theme throughout the Old Testament. Remembering. God's remembering. God remembers Leah. He sees how she seems to have been forgotten, how she's being pushed aside, ignored by her husband, but God doesn't miss. God remembers that she is there. God remembers Sarah. God remembers all throughout the Old Testament. God remembers his people while they are in captivity in Egypt. And they call on God to remember them. But what they remember here about Jerusalem, though, is not the worship of the Lord. It's remember what they did to us. Don't forget it. Remember how they treated us. It's not remember in my favor. It's not remember me. It's remember the bad that they did. Remember against them. And you realize the word blessed here in this last verse, this jarring verse, really, when he says, blessed shall be he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. It's the very word that begins the entire book of Psalms. It's ashrei in you. It's blessed. It's happy. It's not just blessed. It's happy is the person who can carry out that action. And so we've gone from blessed or happy is the man who makes the law of the Lord his delight to happy is the one who throws your little ones against the rock. Now, I think there have been some people who have been able to read this in a different way and to see how somehow this is a worshipful state of mind. It's hard for me to do that with this particular verse, and I think it's a key to understanding what's happening here in this psalm. Worldliness creeps into the very heart of practicing religion. It's ignoring that God has given us a message of hope. And if you flip ahead to Psalm 138, you'll see that the change that's needed is right there from Psalm 137 to 138. David says, if you look ahead, you'd see, I give you thanks with my whole heart. Before the gods, I sing your praise. It doesn't matter where he is. He doesn't need to be in Jerusalem. And David wasn't most of the time, at least in his early life. He was on the run from Saul. He was all over Israel. He had every reason to be upset and, by the way, to be calling out curses on Saul. But he didn't do that. And here in Psalm 138, which was very likely written before he was ever king, while he was out on the run, he says, before the gods I will sing your praise. What does that mean? He's not saying just before you, God, but in the foreign place, right? In the presence of those foreign gods. Doesn't matter where he is, he's worshiping God. And the next verse, I will bow my head toward your holy temple. In other words, he's not there at the temple. He's out somewhere else. It's like, which direction do I bow, right? Which direction is Jerusalem? I will, when I'm away from Jerusalem, be able to worship you, even though the circumstances of my life are such that it doesn't make logical sense to worship. The problem for Israel was that they had grown so accustomed to the familiar that they had stopped really worshiping God. It wasn't about God, it was about themselves. That need for the right setting, the familiar routine. God had called them not simply to worship together, but to be a light to the Gentiles. From the very beginning, Israel was formed for that reason. And when that second temple was built, there was a court of the Gentiles, a place where Gentiles could go near to the temple, so that they could get close to what was happening, what worship for God looked like. It was an evangelistic endeavor, Israel was, from the very beginning. And so we see a connection, because we as a church, not just this church, but the church is a city set on a hill, a lamp in a darkened room. At least that's what we've been called to be. And as for this last phrase, it's one that goes unanswered, of course, in this psalm. It's a request. Blessed shall be he who repays you with all that you have done to us. Blessed shall be he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the Rocket Mounts for request to do to the captors what they have done to us. So how does God answer it? Not in the way anyone would expect. They were making things up, at least I wouldn't. Certainly not in the way the writer of the Psalms expected, at least I don't think so. The request is for God to see that the children of the enemy are dashed against the rock. Simply put, God answers this by dashing his own son against the rock. The cycle of revenge will not end by granting this request. It wouldn't solve the problem. It would just exacerbate the problem and continue the cycle of revenge. But God dashes his own son against the rock of Golgotha, the crucifixion, so that we can go free. We who are constantly seeking to even the score, God evens the score, all right. He takes that vengeful attitude at the heart that he sees in the psalmist, and he says, that doesn't need to be granted, it needs to be forgiven. And that required the rock of Golgotha. What Christ did there answers all three problems of this psalm. It answers the problem of our preoccupation with the past, with others. How do you forgive others so that you can go on? There are stories in the New Testament we don't have time to look at that help us to answer the internal problem of how can I forgive somebody something that seems unforgivable. And the resources for that are in recognizing the much greater sins that I have been forgiven of by God so that I can say, I can do this because my whole life is resting on forgiveness that I couldn't earn. And now I can freely give that to someone else in the past because Jesus forgave you. Or you get over your preoccupation with forms, with it has to be this way and this place or else I can't worship God. Well, notice that Jesus died outside the city. He wasn't even in Jerusalem. This means the greatest act of worship and obedience didn't take place at the temple. It didn't even take place in Jerusalem. We're told that Jesus died. He was crucified outside of the city. He took that love for God on the road. He obeyed God's will out of that familiar place of worship outside of the city. And how do you get over your worship of self? When you look to the cross, you see someone infinitely more worthy of being preoccupied with and of giving your heart and its affections to. It helps us get over our past with others. It helps us get over our preoccupation with forms and to get over our preoccupation with self. It frees us to worship God in the place that he's called us to. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this psalm. We thank you for the fact that the psalmist is unfiltered here, and the fact that he says what's on our heart, and to his credit, in this inspired bit of scripture, the psalmist does give us an unfiltered sort of guttural response, the kind of thing that we may feel and bottle up sometimes, but is nevertheless very often in our hearts as well, and we don't usually express that. Sometimes we may keep that in instead of saying it because we feel that it's unchristian to have those feelings. But we thank you that they are expressed here so that we can draw them out of our own heart and life and recognize them. And through your holy word, we can see who we are as in a mirror. And we can also see all of these things in light of your son, Jesus, and how he's come to change all of that. Psalmists didn't have your son. They didn't know the whole plan of salvation. They couldn't be expected, quite like we can, to look at things in terms of the cross, but we cannot, Father. And I pray that that would transform the way that we love, the way that we worship you. We ask these things.